Thank you to MTV for giving me this opportunity to thank the fans, to thank you for what you've done. And the fact that this is a fan-voted award and you voted for this, I appreciate it so much. And if you are over 18, please register to vote for something else that's very important.
We love you too, Taylor. Well done. Thank you.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
It ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
But we're working on it.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, in Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, and Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADRM, Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet to the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. As you heard, that was Taylor Swift at the Video Music Awards
MTV.
On MTV on Monday. I'm sorry. See, it's been a long and hot week, so sorry about that in advance. The VMAs on Wednesday night, thanking fans for that fan favorite award and encouraging everyone who is 18 or older to get out and register this year. We'll talk a little bit more about voter registration and the fight to prevent many of you from being able to do so in a little bit. Also coming up a bit later this hour, as impressed as we all were in general with the David Muir and Lindsay Davis, the ABC News moderators at Tuesday's presidential debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, including the fact that they actually fact-checked. Can you imagine that? Fact-checked.
Shocking.
I know. Hi, Desi Doyen,
Hi.
By the way. Pretty much, I think that was the first time in any presidential debate, to my knowledge, that there was actual fact-checking going on. Just a few of the most appalling and dangerous lies that were repeated by the former president at the debate. But still, we'll take it. The debate in which Harris simply destroyed Donald Trump by virtually every measure and every account, even over on Fox News, where they seem to admit as much. As good as Muir and Davis were in moderating much of the debate, once again, the most existential issue of our lives and perhaps in the history of humanity, climate change, once again got short shrift at that debate, as is, of course, the long tradition of presidential debates at this point.
But at least it made it into the debate, which is an improvement over what we can expect.
Your bar is pretty low for this sort of thing after this many years. Anyway, we discussed that a bit in our upcoming Green News Report with Des later this hour. But the extra super duper irony slash outrage of that is the fact that even as the debate was going on Tuesday night, an extreme heat wave and dozens of climate change intensified fires, wildfires, were raging across the U.S. West, and they still are, by the way, along with the evacuations of tens of thousands of people here in Southern California alone. And, oh yeah, a major climate change intensified Category 2 hurricane, Hurricane Francine, was slamming into Louisiana. But still, the moderators waited nonetheless until the very last question of the night on Tuesday to even bring up the matter of climate change before giving the candidates, just 60 seconds each to answer to what they would do about it if they were elected. And of course, by the way, Donald Trump failed to speak to the actual question at all in his rambling, ridiculous response. But all of that came on the heels of another climate-intensified hurricane, Typhoon Yagi, that as the week began this week, we were reporting on it. It had slammed Vietnam over the weekend, as we reported at the time, that at least 34 lives had been lost during that storm and its aftermath before we went on the air to discuss it on Monday. Sadly, we've got an update today, about 5 days later, as the storm has received virtually zero coverage here in the U.S., it seems to me. And as we didn't have time to touch on it in our latest Green News report, given our debate coverage, I wanted to touch on it here briefly. Allow me this quick update. Nearly 200 people have now died in Vietnam in the aftermath of Typhoon Yagi, and 128 are still missing as flash floods and landslides take their toll, according to state media on Thursday. Vietnam's VN Express newspaper reported that 199 people have been confirmed to have died, while more than 800 were injured. In the capital of Hanoi, where many shops and businesses have been destroyed, floodwaters from the Red River receded slightly on Thursday, but many areas were still inundated with water neck high in some places. The flooding in Hanoi has been reportedly the worst in two decades. Residents started evacuating the area on Tuesday as the floodwaters rose, and power and drinking water have been cut since Wednesday. Yagi was the strongest typhoon to hit the Southeast Asian country in decades. It made landfall on Saturday with winds up to 92 miles per hour. Despite weakening on Sunday, downpours continued and rivers remain dangerously high. The death toll spiked earlier this week since our previous coverage as a flash flood swept away the entire hamlet of Long Nu in northern Vietnam's Lao Cai province on Tuesday. Hundreds of rescue personnel worked tirelessly on Wednesday to search for survivors, but as of Thursday morning, 53 villagers remained missing, according to VNE Express, while seven more bodies were found, bringing the death toll there alone for now to 42. Floods and landslides have caused most of the deaths in the wake of the original storm coming ashore. On Monday, as we noted that day, a steel bridge had collapsed, sending 10 cars and trucks into a river in one of the provinces, and a bus carrying 20 people was swept away by flooding in another, killing dozens of people. Experts say that storms like Typhoon Yagi are getting stronger due to, say it with me, climate change. As warmer ocean waters provide more energy to fuel them, leading to higher winds and heavier rainfall. It was record warm water in the Gulf of Mexico this week that helped spin up the rapid intensification of Hurricane Francine almost overnight, surprising forecasters by eventually becoming a Category 2 storm as it hit the Louisiana coast. The Francine has since dropped some 9 inches of rain in parts of Louisiana as it thankfully moved quickly over parts of the state, including New Orleans, where hundreds of thousands are currently without power as we go to air today, and as remnants of the storm wreak havoc up the Mississippi Valley over the next several days. But of course, 60 seconds for, you know, each for the two presidential candidates to answer the question as to what they would do about climate change during what is likely to be the one and only debate before Election Day between the two candidates for president, one of whom will lead the nation and the world on climate change efforts on the next 4 years. Just 60 seconds. I say one of whom will lead the nation and the world on climate change for the next 4 years, I should add, or not, depending on which one wins. And another follow-up today on a point raised by a caller to the show earlier in the week, who raised the point that he hoped that the National Guard would be deployed outside of the U.S. Capitol on January 6 next year in the event that Kamala Harris wins this November to help avoid a repeat of the Donald Trump-incited deadly attack on the in the U.S. Capitol back in January of 2021. The last time that Trump lost a presidential election, well, I guess, Des, someone in D.C. must be listening to the broadcast or something like that. Because, good news for that caller, last night, as Politico reports, the federal government has, for the first time, declared that the certification of the presidential electoral college vote next year will be treated as a, quote, national special security event. An acknowledgement that the once routine part of the democratic process now carries special risk. The designation by Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas places the January 6th session of Congress next year on the same security footing as major events like presidential inaugurations, political conventions, the Super Bowl, the UN General Assembly, or maybe when Taylor Swift receives an award at the MTV Video Music Awards. Anyway, this authorization is aimed at preventing a reprise of the riot at the Capitol by supporters of Donald Trump seeking to overturn the results of the 2020 election 4 years ago. Eric Ronagon, special agent in charge of the Secret Service's Dignitary Protective Division, said in a statement on Wednesday, calling the designation, quote, national special security events are events of the highest national significance. He said the U.S. Secret Service, in collaboration with our federal, state, and local partners, are committed to developing and implementing a comprehensive and integrated security plan to ensure the safety and security of this event and its participants. This event that very few people ever used to even pay attention to January 6th. We did, but most people didn't even know the January 6th was going on. The announcement underscores the tense political environment, says Politico, with polls showing Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris in a close race and a bitterly divided electorate. The designation empowers the Secret Service to lead security planning and provide extensive resources to state and local authorities, assisting with its implementation. It will mean unprecedented levels of security when Congress certifies the results of the presidential election. That said, the threat may be coming from inside the House, as they say, this year with Republicans, as we've been discussing now for many months, you know, planning to challenge the results of the election, depending on who actually wins it. The January 6th Select Committee in the U.S. House that had investigated Trump's effort to subvert the election, says Politico, urged the Biden administration to consider declaring next year's January 6th joint session a major security event. That in its the committee's final report. Former acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf, appointed by Donald Trump, by the way, recommended such a designation in order to unlock new tools for security agencies to deploy in preparation for next year's event. In its announcement on Wednesday, the Secret Service said the move followed a request from D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser. It also said that, quote, a formal planning process is now underway.
Good.
And an executive steering committee would begin meeting in the coming weeks. On January 6, 2021, of course, thousands of Trump supporters who embraced his lies about a stolen election breached the Capitol in a bid to stop the certification of Joe Biden's win. The mob overwhelmed the outnumbered police on scene until reinforcements arrived from the National Guard and local law enforcement. More than 140 law enforcement officials attacked by Trump's MAGA mob were critically injured that day as they defended the Capitol and as the then president sat in the White House and did nothing for hours. Nothing other than watch all the fun on Fox News, I guess I should note. According to the Washington Post, the Capitol Police now have 2,200 sworn officers. That's about 250 more than they had 4 years ago. That, according to Capitol Police Chief J. Thomas Manger, who took over the force 6 months after the 2021 riot. He said that plans are already in place to mobilize thousands of officers from the region and elsewhere to help if needed during the Electoral College certification next year, noting in reference to what happened in 2021, quote, "We are better equipped, better trained, and have a better operational plan than we did on January 6th. Unlike 4 years ago," he said, when debate raged over delays in the Trump administration's mobilization of the National Guard, Manger now has the authority to make the request himself.
Good.
Without going through a more cumbersome process that was previously in place. After this year's elections, Manger said, quote, "We'll get a clearer picture of what we might expect on January 6th. And at the inauguration, depending on what we hear and what happens, we will plan accordingly." Right. What he is saying is if Donald Trump wins, there will likely be no problems at all on January 6th or on January 20th for the inauguration. If Trump loses, however, he will absolutely claim that he won. Plan on it. And his Republican Party is likely to go along with him. Whether there is any evidence to support that claim or not. And Trump supporters, unlike Kamala Harris's, will try to do whatever they can to stop her certification as the next president of the United States. As I say, count on it. Bank on it. In any event, it makes sense for the nation's law enforcement apparatus to count on it right now, and it sounds as if they are.
Yeah, it's interesting that Politico at the very top of that article called it a tense political environment when, as they acknowledge, the Capitol Police acknowledge, the threats are all coming from one side.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, that's why they're waiting until they see what happens on election day to see if they even need to worry about any of this.
Yeah, that's not a tense political environment. That is threats from right-wing terror groups and right-wing fomenters of
Thank
violence.
You. Yep. Speaking of the presidential election this November, a bit of perhaps uplifting news before I no doubt go on to ruin it with all the subsequent news throughout this hour. Actually, one of the depressing news items that I had planned to cover turns out at the last minute it has had a twist.
Good.
And it's actually a good news story.
Yay.
Coming up in the next block. Anyway, for now, here's a bit more good news, I think, for lovers of democracy. We are seeing the first of the new polling following Kamala Harris's absolute destroying and humiliating of Donald Trump during the presidential debate in Philadelphia on Tuesday. And as anyone who watched that televised evisceration of the disgraced and convicted former president might have expected, it is so far anyway, good news for Vice President Harris. Now, this is not the sort of snap polling that we saw immediately after the debate of people who had, a small group of people who had watched it, in which, according to CNN's snap polling that night, for example, 63% of poll watchers believed that Harris outperformed Donald Trump, compared to 37% who thought that Trump won that debate on Tuesday night. I don't know what they were watching. Anyway, this is not like that. This is actual polling of the general electorate, which includes folks who may or may not have watched the debate on Tuesday. According to Reuters, Kamala Harris now leads Republican Donald Trump 47% to 42% nationally in the race to win the November 5 election, increasing her advantage after the debate against the former president that voters largely think she won. That is according to a two-day Reuters Ipsos poll that began on Wednesday, so the day after the debate, and closed on Thursday. The poll showed Harris with a 5 percentage point lead among registered voters, which is just above the 4-point advantage that she had over Trump in the same poll in late August. Among voters who said that they had heard at least something about Tuesday's debate, 53% said Harris won. Now you think, well, if 53, that's all, 53%? It's a majority, but not a huge majority. Well, just 24% said that Donald Trump won. The rest of the folks saying that either neither of them had or they didn't answer the question for some reason. 52% of voters familiar with the debate said Harris, quote, gave the impression of having higher moral integrity compared to 29% who said the same about Trump. That I guess he has higher moral integrity? Really? 53% of Republican voters in the poll said that Trump won the debate. And I should note, just 53% of Republican voters in this poll said he won the debate. That compared to 91% of Democrats who said that she was the victor. Among Republicans, 31% said nobody won. And 14% of Republicans said Harris got the better of Trump. Asked which of the two appeared more dignified at the, I guess that's a way to ask about who appeared to be more presidential. 56% of people familiar with the debate picked Harris compared to just 24% who said Trump appeared to be more dignified. 49% said Harris, quote, seemed like someone who would listen to me and understand my concerns. Just 18% saw Trump that way, which is interesting because, you know, in one of the in 2016 and in the years thereafter, a lot of the claims of the people who supported Donald Trump were that, oh, he understands my problems. Mm-hmm. Now, how a billionaire who has never, you know, seen a real day of work in his life would understand how the bulk of Americans feel is a different question. But for some reason, a lot of people felt that way about him. Now, at least in this poll, just 18% see Trump that way. As Reuters correctly points out, while national surveys, including Reuters Ipsos polls, give important signals on the views of the electorate, it is actually the state-by-state results of the Electoral College that determine the winner, with a handful of battleground states likely to be decisive this year. But these numbers, albeit just one single poll so far, they could, in fact, give us an indication of how things are going after that rout by Harris on Tuesday, and would also suggest that Donald Trump would be wise to push for another debate, a mulligan, if you will, so he could try to come back from the punishing performance that he faced from Harris in Philadelphia. As we discussed in our special coverage yesterday following the Tuesday's debate with Digby and Driftglass, the Harris campaign immediately afterwards said that, you know, that was great. Let's do another one. When in truth, as I noted on yesterday's show, there's no reason for Kamala Harris to do another one. I'm not sure there's much left to add. Kind of want to say, stop. He's taken enough. but I think that the push for another debate by Team Harris may not be unlike their push to have open mics throughout the debate that led to Team Trump insisting that they, you know, no, we don't want them open throughout the debate. We want them muted while the other candidate was speaking. And that did not serve Donald Trump very well. So I think they sort of catfished him there. And I think they may be trying to do something similar by pushing for another debate here in presumption that Team Trump is going to say, well, no, we don't want another debate. If she wants one, we don't want one. And that may be working as of Thursday anyway. Trump said that he was not going to do another debate. And really, who can blame him after he got whooped so badly the first time? It's not like he's going to suddenly, you know, get any better at this. So far, good news for democracy fans out there, at least in this poll. But this is only one, and things can, as you know, change pretty quickly now that we're not in Kansas anymore. Also, as we've been reporting now for some time, there are a whole bunch of efforts at the same time underway by Republicans all across the country to, if they can't win by having popular policies or a non-terrible presidential standard bearer allowing them to get the most vote, well, they are now hoping to win in other ways by, for example, making it as difficult as possible for certain voters to cast their vote at all. Some of those stories are straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Linda Ronstadt. I'm sure she's not speaking about Donald Trump in that song, right?
Not back then.
Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com. You heard superstar Taylor Swift at the top of the show urging folks at the Video Music Awards on Wednesday night to register and vote this year after her huge endorsement of Vice President Kamala Harris just 30 minutes or so after Harris dominated Trump in Tuesday's debate. She signed her endorsement, Taylor Swift, Childless Cat Lady, in a direct shot at Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance, who has repeatedly used that phrase to attack women who do not have children for some reason. Anyway, Swift, who has something like 300 million followers or something on Instagram, where she had posted her endorsement. She also asked her followers to visit vote.gov to register to vote that night. And more than 300,000 of her fans apparently took her up on that by visiting the site in the 24 hours after that endorsement. But as to, yes, Linda Ronstadt, apparently she also felt compelled to speak out against Donald Trump in advance of this Thursday's rally at an indoor venue that is named for her in Tucson, Arizona, the Linda Ronstadt Music Hall. Apparently Donald Trump is going there for a rally.
Yep.
So she thought she ought to say something about it.
Yes, the
Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, an 11-time Grammy-winning music legend and a Tucson native, announced that she, too, has now endorsed Kamala Harris in a statement that was shared on her Instagram on Wednesday night, writing that Trump's brutal and cruel family separation policy at the U.S.-Mexico border during his first term in office, quote, remains a humanitarian catastrophe. She added that she deplores, quote, his toxic politics, his hatred of women, immigrants, and people of color, his criminality, dishonesty, and ignorance. Ronstadt also called out Trump's running mate, with photo of herself smiling while holding her pet. She added, quote, P.S. to J.D. Vance, I raised two adopted children in Tucson as a single mom. They are both grown and living in their own houses. I live with a cat. Am I a half-childless cat lady because I'm unmarried and didn't give birth to my kids? Call me what you want, but this cat lady will be voting proudly in November for Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. So, yeah, a good week for the Harris-Walz ticket so far, but there is still a long way to go in the just over 50 days now between today and the close of polls on Election Day, November 5, that I'm calling this phase one of this year's election. And there are a lot of hurdles for American democracy to collectively overcome between now and then, unfortunately, much less beyond it in phase two, which we will get to in the days ahead, of course, phase two beginning, well, pretty much as of the close of polls on Election Day.
November 5.
Here's just one example that you may feel free to start worrying about right now, as vote-by-mail ballots are right now beginning to go out around the country in a number of states. Kansas Republican Secretary of State Scott Schwab wrote a formal letter this week to the United States Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, as appointed by Donald Trump, concerning the disenfranchisement of about 1,000 Kansas voters in the state's August 20 primary election. During the election, Schwab said, more than 18% of voters did so by mail, and pointed out that Kansas law requires that an advance mail ballot be postmarked no later than 7 p.m. on Election Day and received within 3 days of the election in order for the ballot to be counted. That's the law, the state law in Kansas. The problems, he explained in his letter to DeJoy on Tuesday, come with the rules being met, but some ballots were still not delivered on time. Quote, I am extremely concerned that there is a troubling pattern that persists in the U.S. Postal Service processing and handling of ballots, Schwab said. Many are either missing postmarks or failing to reach the county election office in time, even when voters have mailed them timely. Schwab said multiple county election officials notified his office, quote, that ballots were received from the local post office days, if not weeks, after they were placed in the custody of the USPS under the assumption that they would be received and counted by county election officials. The Kansas Secretary of State said some ballots delivered to county election officials also lacked proper postmarks. Quote, a post-election survey of Kansas's 105 counties revealed that nearly 1,000 ballots were received and are continuing to be received. The Kansas primary was August 20. And the letter was sent some 3 weeks after Election Day. So they were still receiving ballots 3 weeks after Election Day. Nearly 1,000 ballots received in approximately half of the counties came without a postmark or after the 3-day grace period following the election, making those ballots ineligible to be counted, despite being mailed before Election Day. A ballot without a postmark cannot be counted during the 3-day grace period, Schwab explained. He said the Postal Service's failure to deliver disenfranchised about 1,000 voters in the primary election, meaning that 2% of ballots transmitted by mail in Kansas were not counted due to administrative failures with the USPS. In Schwab's letter, on behalf of Kansas voters, he requests DeJoy explain how USPS will ensure that every ballot is postmarked in the November general election so that voters are not disenfranchised again, and how the Postal Service will ensure that every ballot placed into its custody before Election Day is delivered on time to county election officers for the vote to be counted. Quote, it is unacceptable that your agency has disenfranchised Kansas voters, Schwab wrote. Again, Schwab, a Republican. But apparently, Kansas is not the only one, not the only state reporting similar concerns this week. Election officials from across the country publicly accused the Postmaster General on Wednesday of failing to adequately prepare for the November 5 general election. in an unusually frank joint open letter, as NBC News is calling it, the National Association of Secretaries of State and the National Association of State Election Directors said that the Postmaster DeJoy has failed to address numerous shortcomings in the U.S. Postal Service that election officials have said could lead to fewer people voting and a loss of trust in the electoral system. Now, NAS, the National Association of Secretaries of State, and National Association of State Election Directors, or NASED, those are both, you know, bipartisan groups, Republican and Democratic secretaries of state and election officials alike. They sent this joint letter to Louis DeJoy saying, what the hell is going on? Quote, state and local election officials need a committed partner in USPS. The letter reads, we implore you to take immediate and tangible corrective action to address ongoing performance issues with USPS election mail service. Failure to do so will risk limiting voter participation and trust in the election process. NBC notes that voting by mail has become extremely popular since being widely introduced in 2020 as states scrambled to make it safe for voters to participate in the election during the COVID pandemic. Nearly 70 million people voted by mail that year. More than 35 million did so in 2022. In an emailed statement, a USPS spokesperson said, quote, we are currently delivering mail in 2.7 days. Although we continue to recommend as a common sense measure that voters should mail their completed ballot before election day and at least 1 week prior to their state's deadline. In July, the Inspector General at the USPS found in a report that the agency did not always comply with Postal Service procedures in dealing with election mail. That's not good. At a news conference at the end of August, the chief customer and marketing officer for the service said that the Postal Service was employing, quote, extraordinary measures throughout the organization as we move closer to the election that will make sure we're fully focused on the effort. Well, I hope so. Despite, quote, pockets of service issues, the agency increased efforts around election mail, quote, makes us very confident that we're going to have a great election season, the spokesperson said. Well, I'm glad that he's confident. The letter from the election officials on Wednesday says they had repeatedly raised concerns with the USPS, but had not seen adequate improvement. This, of course, is just one of the reasons that I have long recommended folks either vote in person at a polling place, either during early voting or preferably on election day, though you can run into trouble, unfortunately, there with long lines or if you find out you're not registered, unless you live in a location that forces you to vote on a touchscreen voting machine on election day, in which case, fight like hell to vote on a hand-marked paper ballot. In that case, it would be most likely with a vote by mail or absentee ballot, and then deliver it in person, if possible, to county headquarters or to your local precinct, if you're allowed to do so where you live, or to a drop box. The worst case scenario, frankly, is the U.S. mail for the reasons mentioned above. But if that's your only way to vote, for God's sakes, do it. But obviously, do it as early as possible. As vote-by-mail ballots are now beginning to go out, I thought it would be a good time to mention all of this, and I hope you will pass it on.
Yeah, it seems like it should be a bigger story nationally.
Beyond that, there are out-and-out efforts by Republican election officials, unfortunately, to keep people from being able to vote altogether this year. Well, certain people, anyway. So on that point, we've got actually, some surprising, literally surprising good news here, breaking just before airtime out of Fort Worth, Texas, of all places. A heated struggle over early voting location sites played out in the Tarrant County Commissioner's Court on Thursday. After more than 4 hours of public comments and dozens of speakers, the court voted 4-1 to approve a list of 51 early voting sites that, yes, include several college campuses that Republican County Judge Tim O'Hare had wanted to remove from the list of early sites.
I wonder why.
The approved list includes early voting sites at UT Arlington, Southwest Baptist Seminary, and four Tarrant Community College campuses, many of which had been removed from a revised list that was presented to the court. Supporters cheered loudly after the measure passed, with O'Hare casting the only opposing vote. So this is good news. O'Hare, arguing for the removal of these voting sites, presented statistics on turnout for voters aged 18 to 25, saying only 5.7% of them voted in the 22 midterms. Data from George W. Bush Institute in Dallas, however, shows that 43% of college-age Texans cast ballots in the 2020 general election. And that, by the way, in a state that has one of, if not the lowest voter turnout rates in the country. So I'm sure shutting down voting sites, you know, that's got nothing to do with it, right? O'Hare also noted that the early voting location at the Arlington sub courthouse is just a little less than a mile away from the University of Texas Arlington site. So why do they need to have one at UT as well? Never mind that many students don't have cars and, of course, find it much more convenient to vote at their campuses, which is why, of course, Republicans are frequently trying to shut down campus voting sites. O'Hare said at the meeting on Thursday, quote, "I've heard all the chatter about voter suppression. If there's actual voter suppression going on from requiring a college kid to walk the equivalent of about 0.6 miles to vote and that you're suppressing their vote if you don't allow it, well, allow it. It's the most ludicrous thing I've ever heard," said O'Hare, who I bet has a car. After the public comments, he said he thought that people's concerns for college students' ability to make it to the sites were unfounded. He had asked one of his fellow commissioners if he wanted to amend his motion to vote on this 51-site list. That guy declined, saying he had faith in the election administrators who had wanted actually 60 to 70 early vote sites. He stated these sites have been approved for decades and that there was no reason to shut them down. Just under 10,000 people voted at the UT Arlington campus during early voting in the 2020 election. That does not sound like such a small sector to me. The university is, however, majority minority, with white students making up just 22% of the student body. Hispanic students are the majority there with 32%. And, well, I suspect listeners can draw their own conclusions as to why some are fighting to make it harder for the 10,000 students who voted there to be able to vote again this year at that one school alone. A number of voters and Democratic candidates had threatened to sue on Wednesday if the county eliminated sites from college campuses. During public comments, Hannah Reed, an employee at the Tarrant Community College South Campus, said she cast the first vote of her life on the campus in 2016. It gave her, quote, immense senses of belonging and camaraderie and solidarity. She called out the lack of adequate public transportation in the Metroplex in her support of early voting sites on college campuses. And again, the good news, just before airtime, it looks like the voters of Tarrant County won this time. The 51 recommended early voting sites, including, yes, those at the college campuses, will be open this year. So that's good news for Texas voters.
That is good news. But look what they had to go through just to restore early voting at a site where, you know, more than 10,000 people were going to vote.
Hey, nobody said democracy was going to be easy and that we weren't going to have to continuously fight for it. And speaking of, that win in Tarrant, unfortunately, is hardly the end of the fight to vote in Texas this year. Texas is wildly corrupt, criminally charged, and impeached, but somehow still serving Republican Attorney General Ken Paxton. Paxton is suing Travis County, that's Austin, Texas, naturally one of the more liberal counties, to block an effort to register more voters before the November election. That, according to the Texas Tribune, yes, the Attorney General is suing the county to prevent them from registering more voters. His lawsuit follows a decision by the Travis County Commissioners to hire a group named Civic Government Solutions to help contact non-registered county residents and encourage them to register. Well, God forbid, they must be sued and stopped. Quote, "We just thought it was a nice thing to do," said Ann Howard, a Travis County commissioner at the Texas Tribune Festival shortly after the news of the lawsuit was made public last week. Paxton, in a statement, called the decision to hire this group illegal. Quote, "Travis County has blatantly violated Texas law by paying partisan actors to conduct unlawful identification efforts to track down people who are not registered to vote," said Paxton. "Programs like this," he claimed, "invite fraud and reduce public trust in our elections. We will stop them and any other county considering such programs." Spokesman for the county, however, said the commissioners stood by their decision. Quote, "Travis County is committed to encouraging voter participation, and we are proud of our outreach efforts that achieve higher voter registration numbers. We remain steadfast in our responsibility to uphold the integrity of the voter registration process while ensuring that every eligible voter has the opportunity to exercise their right to vote." According to spokesperson Hector Nieto, "It is disappointing that any statewide elected official," he said, "would prefer to sow distrust and discourage participation in the electoral process." But of course, what do you expect? It's Ken Paxton. He took a similar step earlier in the week when he also sued Bexar County, which includes San Antonio, the state's second most populous city, for hiring the very same group to do the very same thing. Paxton also threatened legal action against Houston's Harris County, the state's most populous county, if it engages in a similar voter registration effort.
Bingo. It's an intimidation tactic.
The CEO of the group Civic Government Solutions denied being a partisan organization. Despite the claims made by Paxton, the CEO said the company is not partisan at all. The company's bylaws and mission and fiduciary responsibilities are all expressly nonpartisan. He said all of our contracts, 100% of them, are nonpartisan. It's written in. We are under restrictions and obligations to prove that and maintain that and provide that data for accountability back to all of our clients. Harris, Bexar, and Travis counties are all, as it turns out, Democratic strongholds. Aha! Who could have guessed it? In the reliably Republican state. The lawsuits are part of a series of steps by both Paxton and Governor Greg Abbott, both Republicans, taken in recent weeks to, quote, "safeguard Texans' sacred right to vote."
You know, that's how you know your vote is powerful. Otherwise, Republicans would not try so hard to stop you.
The administrators at those counties, however, said that Paxton does this every time. We're not going to let him do it. They're going to go ahead with the program. AP reports that U.S. Congressman Lloyd Doggett, an Austin Democrat, accused Paxton of attempting to suppress Latino votes with these measures ahead of the November general election. Quote, "I applaud the Bexar County commissioners for not yielding to his threats and moving forward as planned." Doggett said Paxton is so fearful that more Latinos, who constitute the biggest share of Texas population, will vote as never before. Last month, the League of United Latin American Citizens, or LULAC, Latino voting rights group. We had one of their representatives on the show just a week or two ago. Last month, LULAC called for a federal investigation after its volunteers said that Texas authorities, state authorities, raided their homes and seized phones and computers as part of an investigation by Paxton's office into allegations of voter fraud. No charges, however, have been filed against those who had their homes searched this month around San Antonio. So, yeah, it was, you know, Paxton trying to intimidate and frighten Latino voters.
Yes.
The targets of that raid, those raids, I should say, included an 87-year-old campaign volunteer. Go get her, Ken. And their supporters all say they did nothing wrong, and they called the searches an attempt to suppress Latino votes. Of course it is. To suppress Latino votes, to intimidate voters, anything they can do to keep, as I said, certain voters from voting this year. By the way, the deadline to register to vote in Texas is October 7. So if you know someone who lives there or goes to school there, please feel free to let them know. Quick break, and we're back with Desi Doyen and the Green News Report. Right after this, I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks. Well, we're not melting quite as bad out here in Los Angeles as
Yay.
The heat wave has finally dissipated, at least here in L.A., so that's nice. Thank God. It's been a horrible week. Anyway, let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
What would you do to fight climate change?
Presidential debate focused on fracking and energy politics, but climate got short shrift. Plus,
that little upgrade from a category 1 to 2 doesn't sound like much, but hundreds of thousands of more people are going to lose power because of it.
Hurricane Francine slams into Louisiana.
Those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The question to you both tonight is, what would you do to fight climate change? And Vice President Harris, we'll start with you. 1 minute for you each.
Yes, you both have exactly 1 minute to explain what should be done about the most existential crisis to ever face humanity. Well done, ABC. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I know you got a lot to cover from the presidential debate, but once again, we got to start with a hurricane today.
Yes, we do. Hurricane Francine made landfall on the Louisiana coast southwest of New Orleans as a Category 2 storm on Wednesday. The storm surprised forecasters by unexpectedly, rapidly intensifying right before landfall.
It might have been unexpected to the forecasters, but I was sitting here saying, oh, look out for that.
Well, you were right. Rapid intensification now occurs more frequently due to man-made climate change heating up the ocean.
Huh.
President Biden approved a federal emergency declaration requested by Louisiana's Republican Governor Jeff Landry, who back in 2018 called climate change a hoax.
I mean, look, if you're trying to go somewhere in regards to global warming or climate change, I think the facts absolutely stand out that it's a hoax. Okay.
No, Governor. Not okay.
Francine is the 7th hurricane to hit Louisiana since 2017. Mm. Francine is forecast to bring punishing rains and floods as it moves north through the Mississippi River Valley over coming days. Meanwhile, in politics, the only presidential debate so far between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump was held in Philadelphia on Tuesday night. Fossil fuel energy politics was a big focus, but as usual, climate change was relegated to the very end with only 60 seconds to answer, despite Americans just having lived through a barrage of extreme weather intensified by climate change.
Including a hurricane smashing into Louisiana, even as the debate debate was going on.
ABC News debate moderators focused on Harris's decision 4 years ago to stop calling for a ban on fracking, a line of attack from Trump and Republicans because Pennsylvania is a top fracking state and critical to winning the Electoral College vote.
I will not ban fracking. I have not banned fracking as Vice President of the United States. And in fact, I was the tie-breaking vote on the Inflation Reduction Act, which opened new leases for fracking.
Harris previously told CNN that she believes a fracking ban is unnecessary because of the booming U.S. clean energy sector. Pennsylvania's clean energy sector now employs 8 times as many workers as its fracking industry.
Really?
Even though new fracking leases will contribute to global warming, Harris's apparent strategy is to signal to swing state voters that she will take a pragmatic approach on energy and climate policy. For his part, Trump has vowed to repeal the Inflation Reduction Act, even though its investments overwhelmingly benefit red states. In the debate, Trump claimed,
"She will never allow fracking in Pennsylvania. If she won the election, fracking in Pennsylvania will end on day one. Oil will be dead. Fossil fuel will be dead."
Didn't she just say she was the tie-breaking vote for fracking in Pennsylvania?
Yes. In reality, a president can only ban fracking on federal lands, which make up just 2% of Pennsylvania. When asked the sole debate question on climate change, Donald Trump didn't answer, instead pivoting to false convoluted claims about electric vehicle plants in Mexico and the size of solar plants. But Trump has consistently vowed to roll back environmental standards and further expand development of fossil fuels that cause climate change. Harris did answer.
"Well, the former president had said the climate change is a hoax. What we know is that it is very real. You ask anyone who has experienced these extreme weather occurrences, we can actually deal with this issue. The young people of America care deeply about this issue."
Harris also focused on the hundreds of billions of dollars in new clean energy and electric vehicle manufacturing investment now pouring into the U.S. from the climate law, but did not say what she plans to do going forward. So the debate underscored the chasm of difference between Harris and Trump on climate and energy, but it also demonstrated the perversity of U.S. politics that treats the existential threat of climate change as an afterthought rather than an inflection point in the most critical election of our lifetimes.
And the perversity of the U.S. media that goes along with it.
Yep.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
The more you ignore me, the closer I get. You're wasting your time.
Yeah, you are. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's broadcast, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. No paywall there, made possible by those of you kind enough to hit a donate button when you stop by or go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Thank you in advance. We rely on you to stay on your public airwaves. Drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.